Welcome to Sci-Fi On Screen. I'm your host, Jeff Palermo, and this is episode number 7. We're going to be talking about Ghost in the Shell. Ghost in the Shell, literally titled, I believe the characters on the box are correct, Mobile Armored Riot Police. This originally was a Japanese manga, which is what they call sort of their graphic novels. And the manga was released in 1989. The film came out in 1995, and most importantly, the film was directed by Mamoru Oshii. Oshii had written and directed a film called Red Spectacles before this, and the Pat Labor series, Pat Labor 1 and Pat Labor 2, which were also sort of about mechs and artificial intelligence and robots. The soundtrack to Ghost in the Shell was done by Kenji Kawai. A bit about versions and subtitles, since this is my first foreign film on Sci-Fi On Screen. There are several versions of Ghost in the Shell. So you have the original DVD, which was released probably 1996, which has the first cut of the film. Years later, as there was a certain anniversary of the film, they released what they called Ghost in the Shell 2.0. And what they did here is they transformed some of the film's images into 3D CGI. To keep up with some current animation trends. A lot of fans such as myself were not happy with that. Although, to be honest, I haven't seen it. But any kind of tampering in that way to what is, I feel, a classic among classics, sci-fi and anime films. Recently, they've released the 25th anniversary Blu-ray. I have not purchased it. I've read some reviews on Amazon. And what I'm getting is that the Blu-ray mastering is beautiful and that the subtitles are atrocious. I'm not a big fan of dubbing, as I'll talk about momentarily, but the subtitles are really bad. Even the characters' names are wrong. Whatever's going on with Ghost in the Shell, whoever owns the rights to it, they're doing an incredibly piss-poor job of marketing and delivering the film to fans in an up-to-date and careful way. It's really kind of been kicked around a lot, and it's a shame because I think it deserves something even like a Criterion mastering. I want to talk a little bit about subtitles and dubbing. Animated films are probably the best case for dubbing because you don't have an exact sense of a character speaking in either language. To put English in the mouths of animated characters that originally were designed to speak Japanese or French or German, not a difficult thing, and I would think the best case for dubbing. However, what often happens in anime, the people doing the dubbing here in the States, they don't understand the film. When you listen to the English language version of Ghost in the Shell, it's a different film than the Japanese voiced English dubbed version. What happens is the animators in the States, I mean, up until today, they look at an animated film and think, oh, it's animated, it's for children. And so what happens is, even if it's a very serious film, you have the worst acting in the entire world. The actors who are brought in to do the dubbing do terrible jobs. They overact. Everything is stagey and big. And there's no nuance. There's nothing given to the characters. It was somewhat better with Princess Mononoke when that was done. I think they used really good actors for that. And Miyazaki at that point, you know, had a real name. So they really took it seriously. I think Billy Bob Thornton was a character. There were other notable actors they did a great job. But for the most part, and I think with Ghost in the Shell, the dubbing is terrible. I recommend this film be watched with Japanese language and American subtitles. And, you know, my own personal thing, too, is that when you watch a film in its original language, especially a film that's going for kind of a strange or uncanny or a fantastical notion, but having the language in your ear while you're watching the film is, in a sense, just another element of strangeness that is presented to you. And as another element of strangeness in a film where, you know, I think it's always great to have uncanny moments. And when things are, quote, uncanny, it's a really good thing. It really throws you or gets you into a film or startles you. Something about hearing a language that I do not understand as sort of just a sonic sense of the uncanny as I'm watching this film, I like. And it's, that's kind of my bit with dubbing and subtitles. I do understand that if the actors are good and care is taken with the translation, dubbing for animated films, if done well, is perfectly acceptable. For Ghost in the Shell, I highly recommend the non-dubbed version. So the film opens with a title card, And it reads, quote, "In the near future, corporate networks reach out to the stars. Electrons and light flow throughout the universe. The advance of computerization, however, has not yet wiped out nations and ethnic groups," unquote. So we open with this sort of bright green wash. The bright green sort of coalesces into computer graphics. And we see they're tracking two objects represented by two triangles. When this anime came out, it was groundbreaking in the sense that it aped so many types of live-action film by doing animation. It really pushed the genre into a whole new place. The fact that an anime would mimic looking at a computer screen or looking inside of a computer network and what that would look like, and then done up with the animation, was a kind of a new thing. And it's really cool, and I don't think it dates very much at all. So we open on a mysterious figure. We know nothing about her. I will use her real name, Major Motoko. She's sitting somewhere with dark sunglasses, wearing some kind of a cloak. And what we're hearing in the soundtrack are voices kind of filtered as if being listened to. And we understand that she's surveilling some kind of secret meeting. And what we do hear from that meeting, most of the words are garbled, but we hear something called Project 2501. But at this point in the film, we really don't know what that means. Again, now we cut to, from Motoko's point of view, she's looking at the meeting now through some kind of X-ray or camera tech. And again, it's this kind of fuzzy type of X-ray visual that we're seeing. And again, it's another, yet another type of visual that's being aped by this animated film. One thing also to mention is the sharpness and detail of the line drawings of the anime. It's very, very well done. At the time, it was quite a different animal when it was seen. And you realize how much care has gone into making of this film when years later, anime still can compare to the quality, but very rarely do you see anything that surpasses the quality of this film, just in terms of the look and the anime that's rendered. You know, it set a brand new standard for anime when it was released, and it's quite beautiful. So now we're back to Motoko. We hear her partner say something about that there's static in her head, and she's saying something that it's that time of the month. Then she gets up, disrobes completely, and she's completely naked. Down in her genital areas, too, completely shaved. So it's a very strange moment. We don't know what's going on in this film that all of a sudden, you know, this woman stands up and is completely naked and is oddly prepubescent. It's an odd thing, and the depiction of women in Japanese, I don't want to say culture because I don't know really much about Japanese culture, but in Japanese pop culture, in anime, and what I've seen, it's a very strange mix of, you know, the innocent and the sexual. But I think in this film, there are a lot more things going on as well, and I'll get into that. So now a bit of the plot. We're hearing something about a diplomatic meeting. Something about a group called Section 9, which I'll get into, but as a viewer, we don't really know what Section 9 is yet. Something about getting hands dirty, so on and so forth. But then Motoko leaps off of the roof, and she lands on sort of a gargoyle halfway down the facade of the building that she was on. The police enter the hotel where this meeting that everyone's listening to is overhearing. Because it's not just Motoko, there are other members of her team positioned in places we don't know. And they're all speaking in their head. So they're all, in a sense, cybernetically connected to the net or to at least communication network. So they're all, none of them are speaking, but they can all hear each other and they're all connected and communicating with each other consistently without speaking. So the police enter this hotel. There's a brief firefight between the people guarding those who are meeting. And then the person who actually is running the meeting yells, you know, who said you should shoot? Everyone stop firing. So then there's some discussion between the officials who arrive and the gentleman who's there, and there's some kind of thing where there's a hacker that has claimed political asylum, or wants political asylum with a foreign country, and this foreign country now has him in their hands, and the diplomat of that country is saying, you know, this is diplomatic immunity, this person is ours, this is technically our soil. The idea is that they're taking this programmer out of the country. Then, all of a sudden, a window is shot out, and this gentleman's head, who's protecting the hacker, explodes in an incredibly graphic scene. And we realize that Motoko had jumped off the gargoyle and on her way down, shot through the window and blew this guy up. all of the armed personnel in the room now shoot out the windows, and they miss her, of course, and then one of the gentlemen comes to the edge of the window to look down, and we see Motoko looking up, and most of her body is covered in this, what they call thermoptic camo. So you don't really see her. You kind of see either reflections or nothing. And then she smiles and moves her hand over her face, you know, drawing down the thermoptic camo, and she completely disappears. So with that very stylized opening, you go into credits. The music in the credits is incredible. It sounds like, if you've ever listened to the Bulgarian women's choir music, these very high-pitched voices doing quasi-atonal melodies, and with Japanese drumming underneath, this sort of stilted drumming, and it's very striking and beautiful. And what we're witnessing in the credits is the creation of what looks like a cybernetic body. And again, it's a female form. And yet, we're seeing this form built up from muscles and bone and sinew and electronics and metal. So as the body's being built, yes, it's fully naked. It's the body of a young woman, incredibly well-formed. It's beautiful. And yet, there's something more to this. It's this odd combination of technology and beautiful women in this film. It's very complicated, I would say. I think it is worth exploring, and I don't think an easy pass can be made. As we're in the credit sequence, we're seeing sort of the little characters that make up the credits and make up how colors and things coalesce in and out. Very much The Matrix. So if you've seen The Matrix, you get to a sense. And there are some things in this movie, too, that as we go on, The Matrix has taken some whole cloth, some just conceptual. But these green characters are something that The Matrix took as well. I think it was a great steal because I don't think it was anything that, oh, you're ripping off Ghost in the Shell. It's like, no, it's an homage to an incredibly beautiful and meaningful film. Now the film opens in earnest. It's a very quiet opening. Motoko, who you've just seen in action, wakes up in her room, and the animation of her face and her hair moving slightly is beautiful. There's this wonderful chiaroscura. I think I'm destroying the pronunciation, but it's the thing that Caravaggio used, right? The deep shadows. And it plays all over her face as she wakes. Then she opens her window, and then the camera just rests looking out at this open window, and the light from the window sort of backwashes, so you only see her then in profile. And you hear the gentle soundtrack, and she gets up, goes into the bathroom, putting some clothes on, and it's beautiful. It's just very quiet, very subtle scene. The camera stays put while she gets ready and slowly leaves, and it's just a very beautiful scene. So now we see a gentleman by the name of Aramaki, who we come to find is the head of Section 9, meeting with a foreign minister. And they're chatting back and forth about some of the background, some of the plot in this film. And the plot is very baroque. It's not easily parsed out on a first viewing. So these two heads of their respective areas, the foreign minister is thanking Aramaki for what happened recently with them taking care of this diplomatic problem. And then we hear some talk about a country called the Gavel Republic. They're asking the Japanese not to harbor a known sort of war criminal who was in the previous regime. I think his name is Nakamura, is telling Aramaki basically under his breath, like, I'd love to send this guy packing, but I don't think we can. The new regime might be as bad as the old one. So there's some kind of subtle hints at some diplomatic issues that are at stake here, and we don't really need to know much now or ever to really enjoy the film. So now the first real action sequence begins in the film. There's a foreign minister official. We see this woman laying out on a table, and the top of her head is open, and strangely enough, it's not a bloody operation, but top of her head is a metal sort of cranial case, which is being put out, and there's lots of leads coming in and out of it. Now we need to get into some of the issues in technology of this film. Two things, especially cyber brains and the notion of a ghost. I mean, of course, Ghost in the Shell, which is part of the title. So the whole cyber brain thing is that in this future that has been constructed, that most people, or perhaps most rich people, have cyber brains in addition to their own brain. Think about an internalization of a tablet or a laptop, or a way to interact with the web actually part of your cranium, you know, implanted in your brain that can interact with your brain. And so your interaction with the cybernetic world is much, much more a natural phenomenon. There's the interface between you and that world is very, very thin. And so you have what's called a cyber brain. And this brain is maintained, you know, and it's constantly in touch with the web. And the ghost in a cyber brain is your personality that comes from your organic brain. So the set of organic memories and personality that you are as a human being and your organic self is called a ghost. And that the ghost is what's connected to this cyber brain. What's happening is this official is being what's called ghost hacked. So what hackers can do, hackers can hack through the security protocols on a cyber brain and basically hack you. They can reprogram that cyber brain to supply you with new memories, a new identity, and most importantly, new directives for your next actions. This we're going to get into as the story brings it up a little more later on. But suffice to say, what's happening is they've discovered that a hacker has tried to ghost hack this foreign minister. And so while it's happening, now we're trying to figure out who's doing it. We get from Aramaki, he's got Section 9 on the case. So they think that the hacker is hacking from remote locations, you know, showing up at a remote place, hacking for a bit, and then taking off, and then hacking in from another location. And little by little, making his way through this foreign minister's cyber brain, trying to hack her personality, as it were. We have Section 9 now on the hunt, and we have Major Motoko in this armored van with another of Section 9's members, Togusa. Basically, Section 9, brief overview, is made up of cyborgs. Motoko is a cyborg. Gentleman named Batu and Ishikawa. The three of them are all cyborgs, and Togusa is not, and we'll get into why very soon. Briefly, as Motoko is sort of strapping up and, you know, stripping her weapon and suiting up for whatever is going to happen next, we hear this story about this famous hacker called the Puppet Master, and that there's this famous hacker called the Puppet Master. He's international. They think he's American. He has this long, long litany of cyber crime that he's perpetrated, and they think that the Puppet Master is the one hacking into the foreign minister. And the cool thing is, while we're getting this info dump, as you know, we must do in sci-fi films, the animation is amazing. You know, they're driving down this highway. As we're in the back of the van, we can see above the front windshield sort of a rear view camera, which is projecting behind the van, and like the road is moving. And outside the windows, we see light poles going by. So the level of detail is incredible. So yes, we're getting the normal info dump, but what we're also getting along with it is this amazing animated world being brought to life. And it's fantastic. At one point, Motoko is telling Togusa, you know, I don't want you using a revolver. He doesn't have enough stopping power. There's a lot of talk about guns in this film, just so you know, by all the characters eventually. At one point, Togusa is like, fine, I'll use whatever gun you want me to use. And then he asks her why he was chosen for Section 9, because he's not a cyborg. Togusa is completely 100% human. I'm not even sure if he has a cyber brain. I think he does have a cyber brain, actually, but that's it. Whereas the cyborgs are tricked out with all kinds of upgrades, strength and stamina. I mean, they're mostly machine, where Togusa maybe has a very small cyber brain that he can interact with, but that's it. Motoko tells him that he's chosen because if all the parts of the system sort of react the same, it's a system with a fatal flaw. And actually, that's the quote. She quotes, a system where all the parts react in the same way is a system with a fatal flaw. Like individuals or organizations, overspecialization leads to death. And it's the beginning of a theme which will be played out later on in the film. So now we're into the chase of these hackers. We're seeing these incredible detailed scenes of the city. The background skyscrapers, all kinds of very garishly lit signs, dozens of different colors and types of businesses, and the canyon-like walls of the city, you know, as they're driving down certain streets. And it is beautifully rendered. And this is a beautiful film to watch. I wish and hope that they get the Blu-ray right, because I would like to see it tightened up a little bit for high-definition technology. But even so, it is a beautiful film to watch in its own right. So right now, we're following two garbage men. we see that, you know, one of them is really doing all the work, and the other guy is making phone calls. And he goes to a phone booth, and he retrieves some little phone card that's stuck underneath, and he makes some phone call. And when they get back in the truck and they're driving, we get this. The one guy says, I'm trying to ghost hack my wife so I can find out why she wants a divorce. And, you know, the other guy driving with him is like, why don't you just ask her? So this guy tells the other driver, well, I met this nice guy in a bar, and he set me up with all the software, and, you know, I'm going to do this and find out what I'm going to find out. The phone that the guy just used, so Batu and Ishikawa now just arrive at the phone booth, the other two guys from Section 9. And they get out, and this bystander comes out with garbage, and they start to question him. And this is the first time we really meet Batu, and he's a major player in this and the sequel as well. And he's a big guy, really big guy, and he's got these metal eyes. So he really looks like a cyborg. I mean, he's from the first moment. Big, tough, cool-looking dude with metal eyes. That's Batu. Turns out that the guy who wanted to dump his garbage says that, yeah, one of the garbage men was on the phone and they took forever. And as soon as we hear the word phone, we hear doors slam, and Batu and Ishikawa take off, obviously, in pursuit of the truck. So now all of Section 9 knows that the hacker is using phone booths as he's on a garbage truck route. So Motoko jacks in, and we see that the cyborgs have four little jacks on their neck, which, again, the Matrix took very much. So Motoko jacks in, and then the camera kind of morphs out of what we're looking at. And from her point of view now, we're into this sort of cybernetic world again. Through all this visual wizardry, she finds the trucks. She eliminates certain other trucks. She traces routes. It's a dazzling set of effects. I mean, it's just very much like the intro. And what's great about this film is you're constantly being dazzled with this novelty of new ways of looking at the world through cameras, through this you know, cyberspace, these cyborgs, you know, the beautiful detail of futuristic Tokyo. Like, you are being dazzled like every few minutes with something new. I think even you watch it today, it's a startling series of images. One of the guys in the garbage truck gets a call. They were tipped off. The cops are checking routes. So the guy who's doing the hacking, who's driving, all of a sudden speeds up. He wants to warn, I guess, his buddy who's planting the phone cards. There's this then cool scene. It gets very quiet. And we see this new bad guy in these Terminator-esque glasses placing a phone card underneath the phone booth. He turns, and then there's this shot where we see the garbage truck, the guy leaning out of the window, waving at the guy, trying to warn him. And right behind him, the camera kind of zooms in, and we see it's Motoko and Togusa. It's a really cool scene. And the bad guy whips out a submachine gun, shoots out the tires of Motoko and Togusa's truck, which tips over. And then he sets himself to really shoot. And it's a really cool scene. It's quieter again for a second. And he plants his feet and kind of splays his back foot out a little bit and crouches a little bit. And then opens up with a submachine gun and hoses the Section 9 van with these armor-piercing rounds. As he's shooting the gun, it subtly moves him backwards. And it's just a very cool shot. Van explodes and Motoko and Togusa do get out, but the van is hosed. Then Batu races in from the opposite direction. The guy realizes he's cornered. And so the little cloak he's wearing, we realize he puts the hood over his head, and it's thermoptic camo, and so he vanishes. I don't understand why when Motoko uses thermoptic camo, she's naked, and when this guy uses thermoptic camo, he's not naked. That's confusing for me. It's never explained in the movie. Take it as you will. Batu tells Togusa to arrest the garbage men, and then he and Motoko set off in pursuit of this guy. And Motoko, in a series of leaps, makes it to the roof. So she's going to sort of take the high ground and follow this guy. And when she lands up on the roof, you realize that that landing, and once she does later in the film as well, you realize Trinity made a very similar landing in the very beginning of the first Matrix. And so did one of the agents. And you know it was an homage to this film. If you see them, if you watch the opening of The Matrix and you know Ghost in the Shell, you'll know what I'm talking about. So now Batu on foot is chasing this guy through this huge market. And again, everything quiets down and we get the sounds and the detail of a massive food market somewhere in Tokyo. And there are rows and rows of stalls and colored signs and all kinds of people. And we hear the sounds of the people's voices, and it's incredibly Baroque drawn scene. I mean, it's just beautiful. And Batu just sort of stands there, and he's lost the guy, but he's patient and he's waiting for something strange to happen. And then you're looking through his point of view, and he's using different filters through his cyborg eyes to look in different ways. And during one of these flips, he sees a guy, he hears a guy behind him go, "Hey," you know, and our bad guy has bumped into him, and we see a brief flash of Thermoptic camo, and now Batu's off in pursuit. There's a basic gun battle. There's wonderful chase through the market, and our bad guy goes through a fence and jumps on some boats, and he's invisible, so we're only seeing the boats move as he jumps. Batu tries to shoot him. He misses. The guy takes out the fence that Batu was hiding behind and pretty much gets away. And now this bad guy is running down a long alley that looks like it could be a street in the old walled city of Kowloon, which is now gone. But again, we're quiet again. The music comes up, some low bells. We hear the sound of his running feet. Everything's quieting down. The camera's looking up at the roofs, looking down at the water, which is reflecting the sky and the buildings. He keeps walking. This aircraft slowly flies overhead, and we hear the sound of the aircraft. He ditches the camo, which has been damaged. So it's just, again, you know, what makes the fights in this film so cool is that the silence and the space in between the action, when you're able to relax and really get drawn in, and the tension starts to build. And then he stops at one point. He gets through the alley, and he's in this open space that has a large pool of water that he's walking through. And, you know, he's framed by all these incredibly beautiful signs and garish neon billboards and that are all around him. It's really beautiful. Now Motoko lands from a roof down behind him. She's in full camo, invisible, so she cannot be seen. And they have this great fight where, you know, he's basically fighting a ghost because she cannot be seen. And eventually, you know, she takes him down. He's down. And then she turns off the thermoptic camo. And she's just framed this really cool badass sequence. And Motoko is badass, man. She is one badass character. And I'll talk a little bit about her very soon and what, to me, a refreshing female character she is in sci-fi action film. So they confront the guy that has been taken down, and he's telling them, "You're not going to get anything out of me." And then we see Motoko and Batu kind of feel sorry for the guy, and they say, "Well, what would we ask a guy who doesn't even know his own name?" And the guy's face changes, and we're not sure what that means. We get a sense that he's been ghost hacked as well, but they haven't really given us the full explanation yet. Then we cut to this really weird sequence where Batu's explaining everything that just happened. Aramaki is out somewhere watching some guy come in on a helicopter. I think it's this Colonel Mollus they were talking about. And again, it's some diplomatic meeting of the minds, and I have no idea what it's about. I'm sure, you know, if you're a Ghost in the Shell junkie and you know all this, please email me, because there are intricacies in this plot that I've never been able to figure out. Then we cut to Section 9 in an interrogation cell. We're looking at the garbage man who's doing the hacking. So what they explain to him is that he's been ghost hacked, and that his memories, his very identity, who he thinks he is, the guy thinks he's married, that he has a wife who's trying to divorce him, but that he's married, and that he's got all these memories. When he was in the garbage truck, he was showing his buddy a picture. We don't see the picture, but what he's showing his buddy purports to be his wife and his kids. They mean everything to me. What they realize is that the puppet master gave him this entire identity, ghost hacked his memories, and implanted all this stuff. And the truth is, the guy lives alone, and it cuts to his apartment. You know, when they went and found his apartment, he lives by himself. The photo that he actually showed to the other driver is basically him smiling. And it's the saddest thing. And he asks, "Well, how do I get rid of these memories?" And they tell him that, you know, the technology really hasn't evolved. There have been two attempts to try to get rid of these things, and we wouldn't recommend it. And that he has to kind of deal with these things that are being told to him were never real, but they feel real, and they're indistinguishable from the other real memories in his head. This is one of the first amazing ideas here. And there's so many in this film. I'll probably miss a bunch too, and hopefully you can intuit it from either realizing what I missed or because you know the film yourself. There's a quote that Batu gives. It's called, quote, "Virtual experiences, dreams. All data that exists is both reality and fantasy. Whichever it is, the data a person collects in a lifetime is a tiny bit compared to the whole. Unquote. So Batu is narrating this, and the camera is fixated on Motoko. Something's getting at her. We're not sure what it is. But what's happening here is the film is getting at the notion that identity is memory. The accumulation of memory, and this will come up later in the film as well, you know, it's the accumulation of memory which gives us our identity. In a sense, all those memories are things that are gone, you know? They happened, but the memories are as fantastical as anything you might make up in your head. Yes, they really happened. You know, when you remember something when you were a child, as an adult, in a sense, in that moment, the memory itself is a bit of fantasy created by a real event, yes, but as a memory is not the most accurate thing. So what the film is getting at is that there was technology that existed that could actually implant memories or change the shape or order of memories in your head. It could literally change your personality. You know, I think about trauma, you know, and people recovering from deep trauma wounds. If those memories could be taken and new memories put in place, and not that this should be done, you know, there's a whole school of thought that whatever happens to us is who we are, and any changing of that is, you know, an odd thing, in a sense, coming from weird reasons. It's an incredible notion to think about. I mean, it's something to chew over, and I've chewed over it for years, and I think it's terrific. And the Wachowskis borrowed it for The Matrix. I mean, when Morpheus is explaining to Neo what The Matrix is, you know, what is reality, it comes right from here. We cut to another beautiful, quiet sequence of Major Motoko in her spare time. Motoko likes to go diving in the ocean. So she takes a boat out to the bay, and she goes diving. And as a cyborg, she needs to dive with floaters, otherwise she would sink. So she's diving, and we see these beautiful scenes of her in the water. And she comes up and dries off. Batu is there, and they're drinking beer. It's quiet. The day is going by. And Motoko very unguardedly talks about how lonely and anxious she feels in the water when she's down there by herself. And yet, in a strange way, how very hopeful. And she talks about how when she rises up to the surface, she feels this incredible sense that she possibly could transform into something else. It's a really neat moment. You know, Motoko becomes a very complex character here. There is something wonderful about her as a character. Here we have... we're introduced to this beautiful female, young female character. She's also an extremely capable cyborg and investigator and soldier, as it were. She's a deep thinker, this one. She thinks about, these are very philosophical and spiritual thoughts she's having. There's no love interest for Motoko. You know, her interests are conceptual. She's thinking about identity, about herself. This is so refreshing. She is really not all about relationships, and she's hot, but her femininity is because she is a woman. She is a female cyborg, right? And yes, there is some odd things here, because a lot of times, you know, she's dressed for war and she's got a bustier on that's visible. You know, there's some odd artifacts here from sort of the male gaze, which are making its way through. And besides that little bit, you know, she is a fully fleshed character, and she's all about her, you know, her spirituality and the nature of reality. I mean, she's a really interesting character. And we get the sense that Batu very much is attached to her. You know, it's, we don't know whether it's just an older brother or kind of Batu's in love with her, but because he's got nothing to do all day and he's just out there while she's diving. I mean, he's kind of like, Batu is sort of the straight man. And while she's going off on her flights of fancy, he's like, bullshit, you know, this is that or this is this. He's, you know, we love Batu. Motoko is the real character here. What's happening is they're drinking. We're getting talk about that their bodies are more and more, they're almost fully cyborg bodies. You know, so much of their bodies and their brains are electronic and mechanical, and they're maintained by the government agent Section 9. She talks this cool idea that, you know, they're on standby and they're drinking, and if they got a call to go into action, you know, there are these tiny micro machines in their bloodstream that could metabolize all of the booze in their system, you know, in a matter of minutes, which is really cool. And then at one point, she's just talking about, you know, we're kind of trapped in these, in a weird way, like these identities of ours, you know, if they had to leave Section 9, if they wanted to quit Section 9 and go into civilian life, they would have to give back the bodies and probably a lot of the memories that they carried. So in a sense, they're kind of boxed in by their job and by who they are. Batu doesn't seem to give a shit, but she brings this up and it's something that's interesting to her. And suddenly this voice quotes, I think it's from 1 Corinthians, somewhere in the middle of that book, the through a glass darkly line. Batu asks Motoko, you know, is that you? And we look at Motoko's face and we know it wasn't her. So very spooky. We're not sure where that voice came from. After this, we get a wonderful day in the life montage of Tokyo. We hear the music very similar to the opening credits. We're getting a sense that Motoko is basically, you know, taking a bus ride through the city. But it's not really about her. We're seeing scenes of ferries on the river and colorful signs and billboards in all different parts of the city and lots of beautiful reflective water shots. And then the day is late and the rain starts and we see people taking refuge from the rain and they're working and eating. And Motoko on a ferry sees a version of herself, which is possible another cyborg body, very similar to hers, since, you know, she's of a certain make and model. We see some unfinished buildings. There's a dog in this film that you see briefly that's part of an advertising campaign, which is a dog in the sequel that Batu owns, and it's a dog that Mamoru Oshii actually has. I want to say it's a Welsh Corgi, but I might be wrong. Anyway, it's a little bit of a Easter egg in a bunch of the films. There's always that dog. We see this really neat scene of a trail of yellow umbrellas, you know, children walking in the rain. And it's beautiful, just beautiful to just sit and watch this beautifully rendered landscape, you know, basking kind of in the philosophical ideas that we've just been given. And, you know, the film kind of, it sinks in and we're given a chance to rest a little bit and just kind of take this film in. And I find it extremely beautiful. Then we're in the evening and we see this naked female looking very much like the body that was created in the opening credits. She's walking in the rain and she's hit by a truck. We don't see it graphically, but we know that it has happened. And then we cut to Section 9, where this body is laying on a bed. We're hearing that this corporation, Megatech, which is a main supplier of cyborg bodies to the government, the Megatech factory basically came on, created a body. The body escaped, hit by a truck, and now it's there. And they're detecting what they think, you know, at first glance, it's sort of just like some weird malfunctioning cyborg. But then a ghost is detected. And then we get this talk about, you know, how could there be a ghost in a cyborg shell? There's no human being there. You know, there can't be a ghost. And it's kind of freaking people out. And we have Batu explain to Togusa that Megatech really supplies most of the bodies that are used in Section 9. And this is why we're all a bit nervous, you know, so we get a sense of the relationship, which is interesting. There's a little dialogue between Aramaki and Batu. Aramaki's concerned about Motoko. She seems kind of odd. And Batu says, "Dear, you know, I put all this information in my psych report. Things are, she's a little odd right now. Don't you read them?" And then they talk about, Batu tells Aramaki, "You know, aren't you worried about the techs who work on our cyber brains? You know, are they to be trusted?" And Aramaki says, "Oh, you know, the techs are checked out. They're given psychological profiles and so on and so forth." And then, you know, we're given this sense of like, if you start to doubt, and I think that's what Aramaki says, you know, if you start to doubt in that area that you don't have the memories that are really yours and things are being manipulated in ways you can never understand because someone is tinkering with your identity by tinkering with your memories, that the doubt will grow into this insanity, which will kind of destroy you. So Aramaki sort of like, you know what, I trust the techs and that's about the best I can do. Again, another interesting little tidbit about what it means to kind of live this kind of life in these bodies. Motoko and Batu have this conversation in the elevator as they're leaving. She's worried, what if a computer brain can generate a ghost, you know, become sentient? She starts to wonder about how much of her original organic self is left. And maybe all the servicing that's been done, they've, you know, strategically erased parts of her that she doesn't even know about. And she's become this, you know, other construct. And then what she originally was, an organic person, is almost gone. This comes right from the conversation that Batu just had with Aramaki, where Batu actually questioned him as well. But from Motoko's state of mind, Batu's sort of like, bullshit, I know who I am. Then we see Togusa who's about to leave. He's sitting in his car, and he's looking at these two black limousines parked in the parking garage. And he realizes that only two people came into Section 9, but there's two full cars. So he does all these cool little, you know, he is a detective at heart. He does these tests. First, you know, we see him reviewing the videotape of the two guys coming into the building, and it looks like the doors kind of hung open an extra couple of seconds behind the last guy. So he's interested in what that might mean. So he checks the pressure pads. They have these pressure pads in certain key places in the building. And he checks them, and he realizes that the two guys could never put that much weight on these certain sections of floor. And he suspects that there are other people that came in with them in thermoptic camo individuals. So he notifies the rest of his team. During that time, this Dr. Willis and the foreign minister have come in to talk to Aramaki about whom they've captured. You see Dr. Willis sit down at a computer terminal, and his hands sort of pop open, and each finger splits into like two other little fingers, so he's like part cyborg. It's a really cool scene. The shell that was brought in actually comes to life, and what the foreign minister tells Aramaki is, you know, let me introduce you to the most famous hacker in the world, the Puppet Master. And Aramaki's kind of shocked the Puppet Master is there. It starts to talk. It's aware. Basically, the foreign minister in Section 6 want to take it back. It asks for political asylum for Section 9, and it starts to explain that it's a self-preserving program, that it is a life form and wants asylum. It says that it's not an AI, that it was sort of born as a node within a sea of information, and it sort of postulates as human beings are. And then as it began to carry memories forward, it gained individuality. And again, we have this theme of, you know, memories and fantasy blurring the lines. What are memories? What are, is there such a thing as a real memory and fake memory in terms of making you who you are today? And the Puppet Master states that when computers were made it possible to be able to externalize memory, it laid the foundations for artificial life. So it's sort of, it's just sort of chiding human beings that, you know, once memory was externalized, AI life was a foregone conclusion. It just took a while to get there. It actually calls itself Project 2501, which is where we hear this name again, and that it's not an artificial intelligence, that it was actually born on the web and is a life form. And at that point, all of a sudden, the unknown individuals attack, the lights go out, there's some explosions. I don't think anyone is killed, but when the lights go on, the body containing the Puppet Master is gone, and we see that they've blown a hole in the wall of Section 9, rappelled out with the body, jumped into a car, and took off. Togusa actually was in that alley for whatever reason, and the car speeds towards the intersection. He runs off in pursuit and has to stop momentarily because of some garbage truck that pulls in front of it. He puts a tracer round in his revolver, gets off around the license plate, and then the car takes off. Then we're in the back of a limousine with the foreign minister and Dr. Willis, and we realize that they've planned this whole thing. They wanted to get the Puppet Master out peacefully, but if it looked like Aramaki was not going to release the body, then they were willing to take any measures to get it back. And especially when the Puppet Master asked for asylum, they kind of had to act. Again, the camera is sort of looking at Dr. Willis, looking out the window, and we get more detailed world, you know, just the reflections and the passing architectural details of the tunnel, and it's a little mesmerizing and beautiful to look at. And then we have a soundtrack swell, and we're into sort of our Act 3 prelude, which is sort of a montage, and we're hearing the music, and then it's sort of a montage of Section 9 as they're slowly in pursuit of this car. We see shots of the evening city. It's raining. Then we get a little more plot information. Ishikawa is sort of diving into the net trying to find information about all this, and he discovers that this guy, Dr. Willis, who was there, is a top artificial intelligence man. There's some connection to this whole thing of the initial hacker who wanted to defect, happened at the beginning of the movie. What they're finding out is kind of this goes something like this, that the foreign ministry created Project 2501 to engage in some not-so-legal diplomatic maneuverings and ghost hackings. And then the program itself went rogue, and now they need help getting it back under their thumb. And of course, the attack on Section 9, because if the Puppet Master started talking, it would reveal all this information. Now they kind of know what they're up against, that they're up against Section 6, and also they understand that the Puppet Master was originally created to be a program, and then it gained sentience, and it is actually a life form. You know, we do our beautiful Ghost in the Shell, lots of different types of scenes now, and we're seeing on the web the chase, you know, the triangle, green blocks that are moving along the highway. Very cool. The car containing the Puppet Master's body stops, and everyone realizes there's going to be a swap or a swap fake. So now there's two cars to travel. So now there's two cars to chase. One car is heading out into something called Old City. Motoko in a helicopter is after that one, and another car is continuing to head along the highway, and Batu and Togusa are in charge of that one. The one car that we see that's being chased by Batu and Togusa hits the roadblock. Batu winds up taking out one of the guys in another very gory head explosion. So they take the car. There's no Puppet Master body, and they realize that now Motoko is actually chasing the body. Her helicopter approaches what looks like this old building. It's, in fact, an old museum. She drops down with this case that she's carrying and tells, you know, her buddy in the helicopter to sort of go high. And she puts together her weapons and slowly walks into, you know, drops down from a trapdoor into a catwalk. And she sees the car that she was chasing in the middle of this empty space in the museum. And she's a little suspicious, so she views the scene in several different ways. And one of the ways sees this shape, this invisible camoed shape that is standing directly over the car. And she begins to face off against it, and we realize that it's a camoed tank. And she, once she figures that out, she tells the helicopter to shoot out all the windows which make up the ceiling, and all the glass raining down destroys the camouflage netting. And we see this cool tank. It's basically like a six-legged tank, sort of a tank that moves on legs rather than tracks. Looks like a giant spider, and it's very, very cool. And then we have this amazing fight between the Major and the tank. We have these intense moments where she arms, loads, and empties, you know, entire clips at the thing. And then she takes cover as it fires back, and there's wonderful animation and as the tank moves against her. And then in between, while she's hiding out, it's completely quiet. It starts raining. There's this quiet soundtrack swells come up. And what I love about this fight, it's from incredible action to incredible quiet and meditation. Incredible action, incredible quiet and meditation. I've never seen any fight in any movie kind of like this, and it's quite extraordinary. So her buddy in the helicopter tells her that there are choppers approaching that, you know, do not have any identifiable sort of communications. So, of course, they are the enemy. Motoko basically gets the tank to expend all of its ammunition, jumps on top, tries to rip sort of the control hatch off of it so she can get inside of it and shut the thing down. She's not strong enough and actually winds up tearing off her own arms. And we see this really cool animation of as she's trying to pull this thing off, her muscles are rippling and sort of writhing underneath the skin as she sort of overtaxes them. They're really cool, beautifully shot scene. And then she rips her arms completely off, fails to get in, falls in front of the tank, and then a claw comes out of the tank and is about to basically crush her head. When we see the tank take several pretty nasty hits, and all of a sudden the arm goes slack and she falls off, it's Batu in his Han Solo moment, who had to go retrieve this huge sort of anti-tank gun and blows the thing apart. So basically, Motoko tells Batu she wants to dive into the Puppet Master to find out what this is all about before Section 9 gets there or Section 6 gets there and it can be taken away from her. Batu helps them, puts the two bodies together and connects them. And we hear finally the Puppet Master explaining what he is. And it's a continuation of pretty much what we were told, that it was created as an espionage program to kind of ghost hack people with cyber brains and to control them for the highest bidder. However, as it traveled through all these various networks, you know, as a sideline of what it was doing, it became self-aware. It became aware, began to create memories, and those memories and awareness created a self. For whatever reason, the Puppet Master kind of got a sense of Motoko, because Motoko, the way she was accessing the web, what her interests were, for whatever reason, took a shine to her and has been trying to connect with Motoko for a while, but couldn't get past the massive encryptions that exist, you know, for these government agencies. So basically what it wants to do is it wants to merge with Motoko, because what it realizes is that it has gone as far as it can go, and it wants to propagate itself. Motoko says, why don't you just make copies of yourself? And the Puppet Master says, a copy is a copy. It degrades with time. It's the same thing. You know, I want to, you know, have offspring. And again, we're back to that theme of over-specialization leads to death. Why the Section 9 team has Togusa, because they want, you know, kind of new blood with different awarenesses and different understandings in their team. the puppet master realizes it has to merge with something different, somewhat similar but different from itself, in order to create a new life. And from that merging, it can then create offspring, which will propagate out on the web. And in this way, it can reproduce itself, which is what it wants to do, as biological systems do. Batu hears this already, and he's kind of about to unplug it, but the puppet master hacks him, ghost hacks him, and freezes him. And at the same time, we see that the helicopters of the enemy are now directly overhead, and their laser rangefinders are sort of zeroing in on both Motoko's head and the puppet master. It looks like Motoko has given the puppet master the permission to merge, and as that's being done, it loses control over both, jamming the snipers up above and over Batu. And Batu puts his arm over Motoko's head, and the snipers pull the trigger, and the puppet master's body, the head explodes. And because of Batu's interference, they miss Motoko but sever her head from her body. And then, of course, they take off. Section 9 helicopters have just arrived. Actually, before that scene ends, we see Batu scream Motoko, and her head is in the foreground, so it has survived. It's a really neat shot. We cut back in now in some sort of safe house. It's Batu's safe house, and we see Motoko's head on a body of maybe a 10-year-old girl with a goofy dress on, you know. We understand that everyone thinks Motoko's been killed. Batu found this body on the black market, reattached the head, so Motoko is now alive. And Motoko tells him that she's merged with the puppet master, so who he's speaking to is no longer just the puppet master or just Motoko, but a combination of both. Batu puts a key in her pocket, and she needs to leave, but she does promise to meet him again, which is kind of cool for us because these two are a really great pair. She walks out, and she stands there overlooking the city of Tokyo, kind of wondering what she's going to do next, you know, as a brand new life form. You know, what will she do? And we fade out, and so ends Ghost in the Shell. The Ghost in the Shell franchise, I wouldn't say it was born with the manga, but it was kind of born with this film, because it spawned a theatrical sequel and then several TV shows. The sequel to this film was called Ghost in the Shell 2 Innocence. It came out, I think, in the mid-90s, so like maybe 10-plus years later. A beautiful and brilliant film on its own. And if you enjoy Ghost in the Shell, I highly recommend Ghost in the Shell 2 Innocence. It also spawned some Japanese TV shows. One, the first season, called Ghost in the Shell Standalone Complex. And obviously, all of the TV shows take place before Ghost in the Shell. So we have Batu and Motoko. And it's kind of great because we get more of their relationship. And it gets to expand a little bit about all the adventures Section 9 had before the events of the Ghost in the Shell film. So we have Standalone Complex, Season 1. And then Season 2 is called Second Gig. And then there's a feature-length film. I don't think it was released theatrically, but sort of a television film called Solid State Society, which kind of wraps up the TV show. And then I've heard recently there's a new series called Ghost in the Shell Arise, which is a prequel even before Solid State Society. And there are several, and these are like long form episodes. I don't know how they're doing it. It's not like a regular TV show, but I have not seen them yet. I am looking forward to checking them out. Actually, of all the rest of the sequels and spinoffs, again, I saw the sequel, which was amazing. And I've watched most of Standalone Complex, the first season. And you're not getting the wonderful anime touches that Mamoru Oshii brings to the world, for sure. But there are some beautiful plots and really great writing. And, you know, you're getting a lot of Motoko and Batu, which is always great. And there's some really brilliant episodes. So I highly recommend that. And I'm looking forward to getting into Second Gig as well and continuing on. As we speak in here in December 2014, you know, they've been trying to get a live-action version of this thing up forever. And at this moment, Scarlett Johansson, I believe, has been offered the main role as Motoko. No word as to whether she accepted it or not. No director that I know of right now is attached, so it's been in development hell for years. Personally, I hope they never make a live-action film. They will destroy it and butcher it. The themes are too complicated, and there's too much sexuality, and there's just too much adult in it, you know? I think it would just ruin the franchise. So that wraps up this episode of Sci-Fi On Screen, Ghost in the Shell. You can find us on the web, scifionscreen.com. We're also on Facebook, at Sci-Fi On Screen, and you can contact us at scifionscreen@gmail.com and also find us on iTunes by typing in Sci-Fi On Screen. So had a lot of fun with this one, and I will see you next time. Hope you enjoyed it.